It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a magic marker. A felt pen.
It's a mistake.
It's a trap.
It's a fucking comedy.
It's quiet. Maybe too quiet.
It's all happening.
It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to talk about movies. Welcome back. It is a good day to talk to Ben Young. I'm your host, Duncan. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, Gardner.
What's up, folks? Welcome back. We got a good one for you today.
On today's episode, we'll be interviewing filmmaker and returning guest, Ben Young, known for his feature films, Hounds of Love, Extinction, and his newest film, Devil's Peak, which is in theaters now in America and available to stream everywhere. If you're listening in March of 2023, it'll still be available to streaming afterwards, but I don't know how long it'll be in theaters. This episode is our second time having the opportunity to speak with the very talented, intelligent, and friendly Ben Young. On this episode, we focus almost exclusively on his newest film, Devil's Peak. But when you finish this one, we definitely recommend going back, listening to our last interview with him, which will be linked in the podcast description, where we got to speak to him about some of his past work a little more in depth. But this interview is also spoiler free. So if you haven't seen this newest film yet, you can still enjoy the interview and watch the movie afterwards. I know we had a great time talking to Ben again, and he shared a lot of insight. So off the top, I want to say thank you to Ben for taking the time to join us again, and I think we should dive into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's not waste any more time. Let's get these folks to the episode. Ben was super generous with his time, and I think it's going to be a great listen.
Here it is, right now, our interview with Ben Young.
We are joined now by a very special recurring guest, Ben Young, who you know from the films Hounds of Love, Extinction on Netflix, and more, is back with us today to discuss his new film, Devil's Peak, based on the novel Where All Light Tends to Go, written by David Joy, which was released in the US in theaters February 17th and is available to see now. So Ben is here with us today. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's so great to be back. Thank you so much for having me again.
Now, how did Duncan do on that intro? Obviously, we've talked to you before, but we still like to ask, is there anything else you want to add? Anything about the new film you want people to know right off the bat?
No, I mean, I think Duncan did a fantastic job. So yeah, like he said, the film was released in US theaters on the 17th of February and is available to stream right now. Unfortunately, I don't have an international date that I can give you right now, but yeah, it should be within the next couple of months, I imagine.
So the new film stars Billy Bob Thornton, Hopper Penn, Robin Wright, Jackie Earle Haley, Emma Booth, Brian Darcy James, Harrison Gilbertson, Caitlin Nakin, and David Calloway. I hope I pronounced everyone's names as well as possible.
You nailed it.
Awesome. Okay. And last time we talked, you were in post-production on this.
Yep.
That was mid last year, and you seemed really excited about the project for obvious reasons. We've now seen the film here and know there is lots to love, obviously. Can you talk about the feeling of now having this film out there, released, and audiences now have the ability to enjoy it and you can see their reactions?
Yeah, I mean, it's a relief. This was, I think, the hardest film that I've ever had to make for a whole pile of reasons. Just mostly, it was just the budget. It was grueling. So it was a really grueling schedule. We oftentimes shot for 18 hours a day or more. And it was just, it had the least amount of resources that I've ever had on anything that I've done, I think, since I was doing self-financed short films. So it was a really, really hard birth. And as a result of that, you know, a lot of compromise was made on set. And I was very fortunate just to have such great actors and such great crew who were supportive of the process and willing to do whatever it took to try and get this thing over the line. So I think the main thing that I'm feeling now it's all done is relief. Relief that it's out there and relief that it's not been crucified by most people. Most people are embracing it. So that's good. Yeah. Relief. That's the key word, I think.
Now, going into it, knowing that that's what it was going to be like, was that exciting? Was that daunting? How did you feel going, okay, we're going to have constricted schedule, 18-hour days? How did that feel to you?
That's a really great question because it's going to lead me to say some stuff I didn't say before. It was all of those things, but above and beyond most, it was frustrating because I was not aware that we were going to be as limited as we were. You know, I thought we'd have a much longer time to shoot the film. And when I got to Georgia to start pre-production, I just started losing days and days and days. So, you know, I only had 4 days more to shoot this than I did Hounds of Love. And Hounds of Love is 80% shot in one house. And this thing is, you know, got a huge cast, heaps of locations, and a lot of things that take a lot of time, like car chases and guns and blood and all of that kind of stuff. So I was frustrated at the limited resources that I had. Yeah, that's the key word, I think.
Well, going off that, because we talked about your approach and you described it as maybe a little more hands-off, where you'll give actors the opportunity to do some improv within the guidelines of the written scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you've gotten the shot that you're happy with already, let them have that freedom almost. Were you able to do that on this film, or was there not enough time?
Yep. No. See, it's interestingly, I did that maybe a lot more on this film than I would otherwise, because when you have great actors, sometimes it's quicker to get them to improvise because, you know, they're not having to find the rhythm of the scene or the dialogue that somebody else has written. They're able to, you know, they have their intention. They know what they're trying to do in the scene. And you just go, look, you know, there's the script, but put that in your own words. And this is what you're trying to do in the scene. And so sometimes with great actors, I find it's faster to impro. And doing that, you know, you don't necessarily cut. So, you know, the minute that you say cut, when you're shooting a film, all of these people just rush in and try and fix all these things that don't need fixing and time just gets sucked up. But when you're improvising, you don't cut. You just go, okay, wait, go back to that spot and say that line again, but like come in way harsher and, you know, like threaten him, be more threatening with it, you know, that kind of thing. And so in some ways, impro can speed things up, strangely, if you know what you're doing with it. It's such a dangerous word. And I think I've only just learned how to use improvisation successfully would be the key word there. Yeah.
Now to go back to what you were saying about being frustrated with that crunch that you had during filming,
mm-hmm.
How do you prevent that from negatively impacting the environment on set? How do you keep everybody kind of juiced up and keep a good energy going on, even if you are feeling frustrated?
That's another great question. You have to act yourself, you know, so you make light of the situation. You remind people that pain is temporary and art is forever. So, you know, I think that the minute that you start, you try and become a dictator and lose your temper and all of that, you lose the cast and the crew. Everybody is in it together. And so being a bully and, you know, picking on people, it never, ever helps. And so you just try and make it as light and as fun as possible, because you'll find that people will work a lot harder and do a lot more for you if they like you and they like their job. You know, if they're just clocking on and waiting for the day to be over and do the minimum, it's not going to help anything. So it's about keeping all of your frustrations hidden and remaining as light and positive as you possibly can.
And you spoke already about the ability of this cast.
Mm-hmm.
Talent top to bottom, obviously. And we spoke previously about really all your films have been great casts. But part of that is you getting that out of them. Even someone as prolific and who has so much experience like Thornton or Haley or Wright.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering how the approach differs, or maybe does it even differ, with someone who has that much experience versus someone like Penn, who is earlier in their career and maybe just doesn't have as much experience. And is there, between the actors, is there even a dynamic that builds, nurturing almost?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Billy was just fantastic. He took Hopper under his wing, and he has done this for so long and worked with so many different actors that, you know, he provided me with fantastic support and fantastic advice. He'd always know if something was going wrong and just whisper in my ear, like, you know, do you want me to, or maybe you should try, you know, and never make a thing of it. And it was always quiet. So he was great. And Billy did such a good job, because, I mean, for Hopper, obviously he was, regardless of the pedigree he's from, he was performing alongside, you know, his mom, who, as we all know, is a fantastic actor, and Billy, who is also, these are two of the biggest movie stars in the world. And so regardless of his pedigree, he really had a lot to live up to. So he was nervous as hell. And both Robin and Billy just did such a fantastic job of putting him at ease and, you know, letting him know that it doesn't always have to be perfect. And yeah, they were just so supportive. And it does. It makes a huge difference with how you approach things. And I was fortunate enough, there were so many wonderfully experienced actors on this film that it just leveled everybody up, you know. Sometimes it's very difficult. And I'm not just talking about movies here, but also, you know, television, when you're shooting in somewhere where there's not necessarily a lot of production. We call them the 50 worders. They are often the hardest people to cast, because simply there just isn't a lot of production in a lot of places. And so when you're trying to cast these little roles for these characters who, you know, have 50 words or less, you really struggle and you end up cutting a lot of them out of the film because they just get, they might do an okay audition, but then when they get put opposite an established famous face, they get so nervous and they just can't perform anymore. And one of the joys about working in Atlanta is like, I was blown away at the experience of some of these people coming in to audition just for small parts. You know, so many of them had recurring roles on Cobra Kai or Stranger Things or any number of the wonderful stuff that comes out of Atlanta. So that was a great experience.
And was this your first feature shot in the US and in Georgia?
Yeah, it was my first feature shot in the US, but not my first American feature. Extinction was also American, but we shot that in Serbia and we did one day in Los Angeles. So yeah, I'm not going to claim that as being shot in America.
So how did that, I mean, obviously, like you said, going to Atlanta where there's, I believe we call it Yollywood.
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of film production experience there. Was that comforting?
Yeah, it was different, but you know, the crews in Australia are pretty bloody good. So, and filmmaking is filmmaking. So I wasn't blown away, I mean, it wasn't a different experience. The crew were absolutely fantastic, but it was just like making a movie anywhere else, really. You know, that was the main thing. I guess the thing that I found hardest to get my head around was all the union stuff.
Yeah, that tracks.
We operate very differently in Australia. So yeah.
But you did get to finish the film in Australia, right?
Oh.
For the editing portion?
Yeah, yeah. So while we shot it in Georgia, I brought all of the post-production back to Perth in Western Australia where I live. And so we did the edit here. We did all the VFX here. We did the music here. We did the sound design here. We did the ADR out of Perth. Yeah, all of the post was done right here where I am now, Western Australia, which was great.
And so for someone who isn't as knowledgeable about the production process, the, you know, pre-production, everything, what does it look like when you're signing on for a movie that's adapted, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Was the novel already adapted to a screenplay when you signed on? And then also when you're filming in a country, America or any other country that's not your native country, how much in control do you have over, like, for example, you were able to bring the editing back to Australia, but is it more, I guess red tape is the best word I can think of?
Yeah. There's red tape at the best of situations wherever you are. So where this one came about is the film was adapted. The script was written before I think I'd even made Hounds of Love. It came to me not long after Venice, I think, after I'd been in Venice with Hounds of Love. And I read it and I really liked Robert's writing. And then, you know, over the years, as I went and did other stuff, I'd give Robert notes and he'd tinker here and tinker there. And then just in all honesty, I'd sort of, I wasn't sure that the film was ever going to see the light of day, but then like overnight we got Robin and Hopper attached, and so then that kind of ramped up things, and so we did a little bit more development, and then literally it was one day we just had Billy Bob Thornton wanting to do it, and it was like, oh my god. And so that just gave us a window that we kind of just had to shoot like right now, and it was a really soon window, and it was tough for me because I was about to go and do a block of television, and so I was like, oh my god, like I've got to step away from this project that, you know, still needs some development, and I got to go and shoot something else. And then I'm literally going straight from that set to Georgia to start pre-production on Light. So yeah, while it was in Devil's Peak, they call it now, I voted to keep the original title, by the way.
That was going to be one of our questions.
I don't know why they change it, but anyway, frustrating. One of the many frustrations of making films. But yeah, so even though, you know, we'd sort of been developing it for a long time, it was just like, yeah, it's a project which is in development. Might happen one day. Okay, it's going, and it's going now. And then you're like, whoa, okay. So yeah, it was weird.
And with that, I know that there's varying levels, I think, of involvement when it comes to this type of thing, but was David Joy involved once you were on the project?
No. So I know David and so Robert Knott, who's the writer, is also a novelist, and he and David met on a book tour thing and just did the whole swapping books, and Robert read David's book and loved it and was like, hey man, this will make a great movie. And apparently, you know, David Joy was just like, yeah, whatever you think, man. And as far as I know, David hasn't read read the script. I'm not even sure if he had the opportunity to read it. I think he was very aware that book adaptations often, you know, yeah, he didn't want to get in the way of anything. He was, I only met him once. He came to set one day, and that was the only time I've ever spoken to him, other than a quick little, hey, how are you on social media.
Talking about our previous discussion that we had when you were working on this and kind of finishing it up, you said that this movie was very funny, and you were correct. Is that a hard balance to strike in a movie that is very serious and has some very serious consequences to add those moments of levity?
It's funny. It's the film has funny moments, but it's still not as funny as it once was. You know, in the process of editing, you know, stuff slips away. And this was a hard movie to cut because it is a slow burn, which you guys would know, and is a lot of brooding, particularly in the first half before it picks up. And so because it's more of a mood piece than driven by a traditional narrative engine at the beginning. Unfortunately, a lot of the humor and stuff, while it was really great, it just wasn't moving anything forward. And I was like, look, I'm still, you know, audiences in this day and age, I'm still asking a lot of them to, you know, be patient with the first half of this movie as you get to know the characters before things happen. And unfortunately, a lot of the humor, while it was funny, it wasn't adding anything as far as the narrative went. And so for fear of making it far too slow, stuff had to go. And so anything that wasn't directly moving the story or the characters forward, unfortunately, had to hit the floor. And that in this case was a lot of the humor. But I'm glad you recognized the bits that were in there.
Do you have a favorite humor moment in it?
Yeah, it's funny. I've seen the movie on the big screen with an audience. And the bit that audiences generally find funniest is, without giving a spoiler, is the scene where Billy Bob's character Charlie is getting a tattoo. But the scene I find funniest, and I don't know if this is, you know, an Australian sensibility or whatever, but is a later scene which is related to the tattoo, without giving away a spoiler, with Billy Bob's character Charlie and Emma Booth's character Josephine in the car towards the end. That's the one that I think their interactions are funny throughout. But because, you know, and I don't know if this is my sensibility either, I played it all very dry and very real. So I'm not sure if everybody gets the humor, but I think their interactions are hilarious throughout, you know, where they're always just biting at each other and yelling at each other. So yeah, that for me is the lighter part of it.
Yeah, she's definitely particularly great in this. And also, I just feel like everyone has, you know, whether you know a meth kingpin or not, met that kind of couple.
Yeah.
And so their dynamic is so fun to watch. That kind of toxicity going back and forth that they play with is so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were so great together that they've kind of, well, in fact, not kind of, they've really inspired me to try and find something I can put them both opposite each other again in.
Well, that was actually something that we wanted to ask about, was the relationships and dynamics between characters. You kind of already touched on it between Hopper Penn and Billy Bob Thornton. And that was one of the main ones. And obviously the mother son dynamic is maybe a little bit easier in this instance, but all the characters, you believe that their relationship with other characters are real. And I mean, a character played by Billy Bob Thornton and all of the cast is more believable in general because he can sell pretty much anything probably. But
yeah,
how do you, especially in a rushed maybe production, I mean, rushed isn't the right word, but
oh, it's the right word.
Okay, how do you get that dynamic going so well, because that's so important for characters?
I think part of it is I was so lucky that I was able to get Emma over the line on it, because she is such a fantastic actor. But she's unfortunately, because she hasn't had that many big roles in the US, she's difficult to sell to, you know, distributors and marketing people. But fortunately, because we had the likes of Billy and Robin and Jackie and Brian, I was able to get Emma over the line. And that was important, not just because I knew she'd do a wonderful job with the character, but because she has worked with me on both my other movies. And we first met when we were 12 years old playing opposite each other in a television commercial. So we've known each other for a very long time. And when she comes on set, it's obvious to everybody how much she trusts me. And then everybody sees what a great job she does. And so it helps everybody relax into their new relationship with me, if that makes sense. So that's a big part of it. So yeah, creating that trust is made a lot easier if you can employ someone incredibly talented who is going to do a great job and obviously obviously trust you in front of everybody else. And that was also helped, of course, by having the same director of photography who shot Hounds of Love. He was great. And all of the cast and crew could see that he really knew what he was doing. And then that's also a reflection of me, because I picked this guy and this guy is really responsive to me. So, you know, it was building that kind of stuff just speeds up the process of getting trust a little bit more. Well, a lot. It speeds it up a lot. And then other things that we do is we had a lot of dinners in pre-production between me and the cast and some of the heads of department where, you know, we just talk. We talk about our own lives and how we relate to the characters and, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
And obviously you're filming in Georgia. Mm-hmm. The film is set in Jackson County, North Carolina.
Yep.
There's a lot of regional accents, regional flavor, hints of just small things that'll ring true in terms of authenticity for people who are familiar with the area and that kind of thing. I know that you visited Silva, mm-hmm. where the novel is set, as part of kind of getting to know the area.
Yep.
How did you ensure, because as someone from this area, this film felt very authentic to me.
Oh, good. That was going to be my question to you.
Yeah. I think the guys all driving big trucks, check. The costuming, check. Down to like some of the dressing inside the houses, you know, it all felt very authentically Western North Carolina. So then my question would be, without having David Joyce so involved in the production, obviously you had the source material, but adapting it to a visual medium, how did you ensure that authenticity?
Good, great question. So it helped shooting in the South. And so we shot about an hour and a half out of Atlanta. So we were, you know, well and truly in the regional regions. It helped having a crew who were from largely Atlanta. And so, you know, they were our bullshit detectors, as we like to call them. But also, for whatever reason, I have always been fascinated with the South. I've been there a whole bunch of times before shooting the movie. And I am often drawn to Southern stories and Southern literature. And I, you know, obviously it's not the same place, but I grew up in rural Western Australia. And so, you know, rural areas, I feel, are very akin to me as a human. And so I think I was able to notice the similarities. And there are a lot, you know, like in Australia out there, you drive big trucks. They look a little bit different, but they're still big trucks. And everyone wears cowboy hats. They're a different style of cowboy hats, but it's all the same. So there's a lot of similarities in its own way to where I came from as a kid. But it was pretty organic for me to fall into that space, not just because of my history in rural Western Australia, but because I've watched so many other movies set in the South and read so much literature set in the South. Plus, I've been there a number of times, and we have family friends who, you know, I know it's a different region, so I don't want to sound too ignorant when I say it, but we've got family friends who are in Lafayette, and we used to go visit them when I was a kid. And so the Southern states in the USA have been a part of my life for nearly as long as I can remember. So it wasn't that foreign for me.
So you had people around you being your bullshit detectors telling you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you visited Silva,
mm-hmm.
what was the purpose of that visit? Was that just to get a real life sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was more for a whole bunch of, I mean, one reason was to reassure myself that we were making the right decision by shooting in Georgia and not Silver. It was cheaper to shoot it in Georgia by a significant way. And, you know, I went there and realistically, it looked almost identical to the part of Georgia that we chose to shoot in, except it was a lot nicer. So yeah, it was research. It was for me to truly convince myself that this was going to look like it was in the place where it was set. So that was the main reason. And to hear the people, you know, in the coffee shops and bars, hear them speak and figure all of that out. Because, I mean, where we shot was only 2 hours from Silver. And so it was not hugely different.
And so we talked about there being a name change.
Yep.
And I do maybe want to ask about the religious aspects of that. Maybe that'll be a spoiler question. But based on that, we haven't had the chance to read the novel yet. So
uh-huh. It's a great read.
We have some specific questions about like point of view actually as well. But were there any major changes plot wise?
Yeah.
From novel to movie? There were. Okay.
Yeah, there were a lot. And it was interesting. It was a really interesting process for me because very early on, Robert Knott told me not to read the book because, you know, the book has a lot going on in it. And there were many different ways that you could have interpreted it and many different, you know, ways that you could have put it together. And I think he didn't want me to read the book because odds of me reading it and 100% wanting to adapt it the way that he had chosen to were next to none. And so that was sort of a kind of interesting approach from him, and also a valid one, I think. And also, oh, there was something else that I was going to say about, oh yeah, and also he wanted me to read his script as a movie script, not an adaptation. So that was interesting. I did read the book just before we shot, just to try and get a sense of, you know, is there anything absolutely missing from these characters or this world or anything like that? And how do they speak? And let's just make sure this dialogue's all ringing true. Sorry, what was the question again? The religious
aspect, or just any major changes between
the novel. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a couple of extra characters in there. Brian Darcy James's character does not exist in the book. I can't remember why we decided to put him in there, but I think he serves the story very well. The relationship between Jacob and Maggie, played by the wonderful and lovely Caitlin Nacon, is a little bit different. And also the end is different. I think that the end works better for a movie, but I'm not sure that fans of the book will like the ending.
Okay, well, in that case, we have a couple more non-spoiler questions, but we definitely need to get to the spoiler section to ask about the ending a little bit.
Well, yeah, and that I can kind of talk about it. You know, I loved the title, Where All Light Tends to Go, and I actually, the sad thing is I think that may have actually kind of made me fall in love with the material more, because it's such an ethereal title, and I think, brings a whole interpretation to the material, which for me is important. And I thought about that title so much, and it affected how I shot the movie. So I was so devastated to lose it, because where does all light tend to go? It goes into darkness. So when they wanted to swap the title of the film, I fought avidly for the title Where All Dark Tends to Go, because where does dark go? It goes into light. So that may or may not give a little hint about how we may or may not have changed the ending, you know?
Well, still talking about the book before we transition into spoiler questions, I wanted to get your take on this quote from David Joy and kind of the influences that this may have had on creating the other characters in the film for a visual medium.
Yep.
He said, "The limitations some critics have pointed out are, in my opinion, the result of the novel being a first-person narrative. We never leave Jacob's mind. The great thing coming out of that is that his voice, I don't think you can have that kind of voice in a third-person narrative, but of course it limits what you can do on the page. You can't be inside Maggie's mind or inside Jacob's father's head." Now, was this a challenge going into making the film adaptation, where now you can't just exist inside Jacob's mind? You have to try to get into these other characters' heads as well.
Once again, you guys are just asking such good questions. Well done. That is a really terrific question. Yes, it makes it harder. We've got this wonderful author in Western Australia, who I will give a plug to, called Tim Winton. He is just such a good novelist. And his adaptations, I think a lot of them are really good. Adaptations to film and television. There's been a lot of them, but they're widely criticized as not being anywhere near as strong as the novels, because he writes everything that he writes is so internal. And you can't film internal unless you have a voiceover. So yes, it makes it very, very tough. And that was one of the things I think that we found. Certainly, my job was not made easy, because the way that Robert Knott puts words on a page is absolutely beautiful. His command of language is far superior than mine will ever be. And so I was sort of seduced by reading this script. But then, of course, when you start putting all the scenes together, you realize, shit, you know, like, it's not actually a lot happening here. You know, there's a lot of, you know, Jacob sitting around looking at stuff, but doesn't feel like it's propelling the narrative, because, you know, movies need to be driven by action. They can't be driven by characters thinking. And so that made it a difficult movie to put together, which is, you know, like why it feels a little slow at the beginning. I don't think too slow. I think it's necessary to build the world. And I think the tone and all of that still make it engaging. But yeah, it's very, very tough to adapt stuff that is largely written written internally.
And I mean, I think it's interesting because it is still very much a story about Jacob and his experience. It's a story about a family, obviously, and the interactions within a smaller community. But it has narration from him at points as well. So it is still his perspective, obviously.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that the limitations that Joy is talking about, for example, would lead to the characterization of Billy Bob's character, for example, is, I think, very interesting, and maybe one of the most morally tugging bugging aspects of it, because you know for large aspects who he is and what kind of guy he is morally.
Yep.
But it still manages to, I think, get inside of his head at points.
Oh, good.
And speaking on that and the novel differences and the differences in just medium and storytelling and changes in the story, obviously, as well, and the dark to light thing, I think that something I was talking to Gardner about is the small things and choices that filmmakers make. And you, I guess, I notice them maybe more when I'm going into a film knowing that I like this filmmaker's work. You know, I've enjoyed your past work. So maybe I'm even more, my eyes are open wider to it. But like, for example, shots like the two McNeelys talking on the porch, and most of the conversation is filmed looking front view head on. And for a few seconds, I think it's only, you get a shot from behind within the dark, empty house through the window. And I think that shots like that elevate it. And I guess I was thinking about it due to the talk of dark and lightness as well.
Yeah.
Because I think that maybe thematically also works with it. And that's why it's not just an interesting shot, although I do appreciate just visually interesting shots in general. But I guess I was wondering, those small decisions, is it all planned? Because obviously, like, there's, you know, you do storyboarding and stuff like that, and you have shots planned out. But on the day of, are you seeing things like, maybe we should try this angle out, almost improvising behind the camera, if that makes sense?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I think that you need a plan. You need 100% plan, so you have something to throw out. You need to know what you want to get, but that's going to change, because for whatever reason, you might be running a little bit over it, and the way that you've blocked it in your head doesn't work anymore because the sun's in a different spot, or, you know, a piece of equipment has died, or, you know, whatever, the lens that you're going to do it on has gone faulty or something like that. So you can never ever be completely rigid into how you're going to shoot it, because there is so much that can change. And also little stuff like, you know, you might block it a particular way and then get in there and see that, God, actually my blocking for this is really static and boring. It's a really long scene. It's not going to work with just two people sitting opposite each other. One of them needs to get up and go to the kitchen at some point, just so we've got an opportunity to move. And so it changes all the time. But I think that you need to plan it rigidly, because in planning, you discover what is really important. And so once you get there, you may find a way to emphasize that even better than you've planned it. So yeah, so you throw a lot out. So what I tend to do now more than I used to is I paint the picture in broad brush strokes. And so, you know, I break the movie into sections. I break it into 8 sections and come up with rules for each one of those sections, and then talk to the crew about that. And so that'll have stuff to do with the kind of light that we're using, whether the camera is handheld, whether we're shooting on long lenses or short lenses or what, you know, just a whole bunch of stuff, what colors are going to be in frame, all of that. So by painting in those broad brush strokes, that's a way of kind of generally maintaining a consistency and a form of control despite what may change and go wrong. Like, I mean, I think that one thing that nobody has picked up on yet, but I think it's really obvious, is the shift in the color palette between Robin Wright's character, Virgie, and Billy Bob Thornton's character, Charlie. You know, there's a whole lot of blues, and the whole palette shifts when we go to her place as opposed to his, which is a lot warmer and hot. And, you know, the whole metaphor of that is, you know, fire and water. So, you know, he's the fire, and if Jacob's going to put out that danger, that influence, he's got to take more from the his water sign, which is his mother. And so they're the kind of broad brushstrokes I find that you can come up with that not a lot can get in the way of when everything else goes wrong. And that's all planning, you know?
Well, we have definitely passed the halfway point in the interview, and I think the film is out, folks. Go see it if you haven't at this point. We're going to transition into spoilers, if that's all right with you, Ben.
That's fine. I'll try and be as vague about them as possible.
Okay, that works. This is a fairly vague question to start you off too, so we'll ease you in here. The last 30 minutes of this film,
yep,
are tense as hell. What was the biggest challenge for you in the editing bay to maintain that tension and prevent it from getting stretched too thin?
Well, that's the easy stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you mean how, like, was it difficult to make that last 30 minutes?
Yeah, in a sense, I guess it's a more pacing related question, because you have ebbs and flows,
yep,
in that last 30 minutes where there's times where it slows down and then it picks back up.
Yep.
For example, the house infiltration is super tense, and then later scenes.
Yep.
So for you, that's fairly easy to get through?
I find action really easy, just because to me, it just jumps off the page. It's the character stuff, which is hard. hard. And so, you know, all of that action stuff was storyboarded to the nth degree. And so I knew exactly what was going to happen. And also, because action stuff is action stuff, that's the stuff that's easier to plan. You know what I mean? Because you know there's no dialogue. And so you know that there's literally only one way in the front of the house and all of this sort of thing. And you know that a car is going to blow up here. And, you know, you can't have actors that close to it. And so that's the kind of area where there's not a lot of room to improv. It's just like, you know, in the story, what boxes that you need to tick, you know? So that's the pretty easy stuff to do, I think. And it's the stuff that I enjoy doing because, you know, you have the most control over it. So yeah, it was difficult. I think the thing that really worried me, which I think is less of a, it's not a problem in the movie, was just that I was a little bit worried that because there is such a shift in the third act. And I don't think that this is a spoiler at all. It's just like, if anyone's watching it and feels like the beginning is too slow, which I don't think it is, I'll defend it. I think that it needs that to kind of build to the end. It really takes a shift in that kind of last third of the movie. I was worried that it became a different movie or was going to, and I was worried about this from the script, you know, that I was like, oh my God, we've got a lot of long, slow character mood scenes. And then from this point on, we're just cars and guns and chases and all of that kind of stuff. So that was more of a worry, was trying to find a way to make that ending fit with, or, you know, that last third fit with the rest of the movie. And I think it kind of, you know, I'll let audiences and you guys be the judge of that, but I think it kind of works. And I think that it's a welcome relief, you know, because the rest of the movie is sort of a tense, slow burn. And then it kind of culminates in what is a really kind of long, in a good way, tense climax, you know?
Yeah, I didn't feel like it was a different movie at all. It felt to me like a logical conclusion.
Good.
Like everything like naturally built to where that third act went.
Well, that's great. And that's what I was hoping it would do. It was, you know, like all of these little nuanced tensions between all of the characters in the beginning slowly boil up until, you know, it explodes and rockets ahead. And so, yeah, good. And I personally think that it needs that shift.
And so talking about the tensions boiling up until it obviously reaches that climax, I had questions regarding the choices with the sheriff played by Jackie Earl Haley.
Yep.
Because I loved the uncertainty I had about his motives. And then at a certain point, just being like, I have no idea now. And then up until really when it's explained what he's going for, I think it all comes together and it adds to, for example, one of the most heartbreaking scenes early on with the mother,
mm-hmm.
when he finds her, and then leading to the younger cop and the antagonization, the retaliation, yep. and then the sheriff coming in. And I think, you know, you read his stepping in there differently once you've seen the climax. Yep. And it also obviously parallels his interaction with that same younger cop in that climax. So I guess the question there is, how do you approach setting that up and kind of, it's almost a twist.
Yeah.
In maybe not the most normal sense, or like, you know, what people normally think of a twist, I guess, but it is something you're not expecting. And I guess, how do you set that up and how do you approach the pacing of that? Like, again, culminating all at the end.
Oh God, Duncan, you articulated that so well without giving too much away. So I commend you on that. Well done. Yeah, that was, thankfully, I had the great Jackie Earl Haley there, you know? So we just, I mean, he is such a joy to work with and such a good actor. And I just love him in this movie. And I've been so relieved to have so many people tell me how interesting that they found that character, because it all makes sense in the end, but you don't see it coming. But then once you see it, you go, ah, that's actually what he was doing throughout. And so Jackie is a real, he does his homework. And so he would send me so many emails and speak to me about his ideas of what to do where, and every single thing that Jackie brings to that character is so considered and thought out. And so that was really Jackie. I'm going to give him the credit for layering that performance so well. And, you know, and it was hard to track. It was difficult, you know, like, because one of the challenges is like, sometimes, you know, one of my favorite notes to give actors is like, okay, cool, I get it, but that was so subtle. I worry that I might get into the edit suite and want to like hint a little bit more. So can you just go a little bit further, you know, just raise it up a little, you know, and we do it. But then you get in the edit suite and you're like, oh shit, if we keep that look, that just tells us right away that he's, you know, a villain, or it tells us right away that he's a good guy. And so that was difficult because Jackie is such a good actor and he takes direction so well that I had every option with him to kind of push him further in either direction. So I'm thrilled to hear that you, what the character did for you was the intention, and he was kind of ambiguous until he wasn't. So yeah, that was tough, but it's helped. You know, I think one of the things when you get so close to material, and I understand you know you're making a short film now, and so you would know this better than anybody, you'd need to get fresh eyes on it. And so that's what we'd do. We'd bring people into our edit suite who hadn't read the script, knew nothing about it. We'd show them the cut, what works for you, what doesn't work for you. So, you know, yeah, if something was being given away too early or whatever, and we were getting that note commonly from people, then we'd adjust it.
I think one of the best lines, I mean, there's a lot of really good lines, but one that stands out is said by Billy Bob Thornton's character, which is, if that needs to go off, it touches mud and water.
That was funny. I think that's my favorite line as well.
It's so good. And then the way that that is tied back into later in the film, can you, I know that you're trying to be vague. And so,
yeah, but we gave a spoiler alert. So
yeah.
You ask what you want. Don't worry. You know, okay. We gave a spoiler alert. So yeah.
Going for it.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the significance of his son choosing not to use the pistol at the end and it ending up in wet mud anyway, as he continuously makes the choice not to kill throughout the film?
Yep. I'm so glad that you picked that up. So look, really what I want the audience to feel is, even though he rejects his father at the end, there's still a little bit of his father in him, you know? And so that's what it's all about. And, you know, had we had the time, I was going to shoot, and we just didn't. There was a scene after that I wanted to shoot that kind of suggested even more that maybe Summer Charlie has come with him. And so that was the thing. I didn't want it to feel too black and white, you know, like Jacob is still Charlie's son, regardless of what he does at the end. And so, you know, I love that the last action, one of the last actions that we see Jacob do is actually follow his dad's advice.
So just going off the pacing, which Gardner and I now both agree makes sense, like you were saying, it's a natural culmination, not like a two different movie type thing. And it does, like you said earlier on, I believe, set up like the tone throughout the movie and the relationships and who the characters are and everything. But going off that, the thoughts of pacing, is that something that went into the decision to have the flash forward earlier on in the movie? And also, just going off that real quick, I want to just say that I always think it's really interesting when a movie does something like that and gets you so engrossed in the characters and what's going on that there are large portions of the film that you forget that it's told you where it's going. It like kind of leads you away from it only to bring you right back to what you know is going to happen without the context, obviously. So maybe, I don't know how that dynamic is hard to maybe straddle during it when you've shown something already, but also like, is that something that was, let's get some action, let them know.
Yep.
Was that in that decision?
Yep. Another great decision. That was a decision that was made in post. The script was not written like that. In fact, that opening voiceover was not even in the script. That's something that I wrote with segments lifted from the book when I was in post-production. And yeah, exactly like what you said, because the movie is so moody and brooding and, you know, takes its time up front. And when I say takes its time, it's not painfully slow. Like, it's not a long movie. It's only like 137 minutes. And so, like, I don't want to scare people off it. But, you know, it did take its time, and it was just very small town America in the beginning. And I felt that we needed to give the audience something up front just to let them know that there was going to be more to this movie than just a kitchen sink drama between a drug addicted mother and a drug dealing father. So that was put there just as a little to hopefully, you know, hook the audience in and serve as a reminder when we were getting to know the characters that this was going to culminate somewhere a little more exciting.
Awesome. And heading into wrapping up, last time we talked, this is looking ahead. You said that you always have a notes page open on your computer with ideas for films.
Yeah. Oh, you got a good memory too.
That still being the case, can you tease any ideas that you think might be coming up next? I think last time you mentioned Western sci-fi, horror, any teases you can give us there?
Yes. Yeah. Well, interestingly, since we last spoke, I went to a film festival with Emma Booth, who plays Josephine in the movie, and she's in Extinction, and she plays the principal character in my first movie, Hounds of Love. And I showed her scenes from this movie, and she got really excited by it. And she said, "When are you going to write me another lead?" And I said, "I have an idea." And I pitched her the idea, and she was like, "Stop everything that you're doing and write that now." And I did. So I won't give too much away, but it's a really, really challenging, tense character drama in the spirit of something like The Whale or The Wrestler.
I'm sold.
Cool.
That's all you had to say.
But it's kind of makes them look like Disney movies.
Now we're really sold.
Ben, that is so up my alley. It's not even funny.
It's brutal. It's brutal. So it's going to be a hard one to try and finance, but I've spoken to Emma, read it and loves it. And I think we're going to try and do it in a really little way, like financially, just in a way that is down and dirty so we can maintain control and take some big swings with it.
Well, we got our fingers crossed over here.
Thank you.
I hope it gets made and I can't wait to see it.
The title is Bleach. So watch this space.
Awesome. So we know that we've picked your brain for a lot of insight, knowledge, everything pretty much with regards to your films and just filmmaking in general. We always do ask for advice for aspiring filmmakers. Last time you said that you have to love the
process,
right? The process, not the result.
The result?
Right, yep. Yeah. So, you know, I think you talked about missing, I think it was for Hounds of Love, a festival shooting at probably Extinction, I think, at the time.
Yep.
And the bittersweet feeling of that, but also knowing that, well, I'm making a film, so that's good that I'm busy. But, you know, obviously that's great advice. I don't know if you have any other knowledge or anything to expand on that.
Well, that's my go-to. I love giving that advice. And that is the piece of advice that I give myself most often, you know, when something doesn't go my way and I kind of think, why am I in this ridiculous industry? It's like, well, you like doing it. And the things that hurt me the most are the result, you know, like, or trying to get to the result. It's the process is great. The making the movie, working with the actors, cutting the movie, writing the movie, all of that's the good stuff. It's just dealing with the brass above me and the putting of the movie out there. That's the result is the painful bit. And that's always the bit that gets me down and gets me frustrated. So it's the process is the good bit. So I remind myself of that the most. But I really think, okay, this is maybe a controversial one, but I'm just going to say it. I hope I don't upset anyone listening, is don't rush out and try and make something that's 90 minutes long. Filmmaking is hard and you get better by doing it. And I think that you're going to probably waste a lot of time and resources trying to put together a feature film when you haven't quite learned your craft yet. I'm constantly watching DIY movies from filmmakers who haven't made enough shorts, haven't done music videos, haven't done the training, and you can see that they're talented, but they just weren't ready to make that movie. So don't rush into your first feature film. Spend your time making shorts and make them short. Aim to make stuff between 3 and 5 minutes and then 8 to 10 and then maybe, you know, just under 15. Don't rush to make your first feature film. That's the main advice today.
I love that. Thank you.
No worries.
So another one that we always like to ask is we want to know about more filmmakers. Well, last time you recommended the work of Zach Hilditch.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to know if there's any other filmmakers, anyone involved in the filmmaking process that you wanted to shout out today that our audience could check out their work.
Well, yeah, I think Michael McDermott, who shot this film, is the cinematographer of this. He shot his first feature film that he ever shot was Hounds of Love, which was my movie, but his career has really taken off and he has done a whole pile of movies on top of the ones that he has done with me. And he's got a real signature look about his work and he's excellent. And so particularly if you're a cinematographer or interested in tracking a cinematographer's work, I think that he is one well worth looking at.
Amazing. All right. So that will be in the description along with everything else. Links to anything that we talked about today will be in the podcast description.
Cool.
So Hounds of Love, available on VOD, Extinction, still on Netflix. Right now, in February 2023, Devil's Peak is in theaters in the US and it's already available on VOD as well.
VOD on the 24th.
So when this releases, it'll be out on VOD. If you can get to theaters, we always recommend that. I think that it's always a better experience if possible, but that's available there. Is there anything else that people should check you out on, anywhere they should follow you if they want to keep up with your work or anything?
Yeah, I have an Instagram, which is, I've had it for so long that it's just my name, Ben J. Young. So I use that. I have a Twitter, which is at Ben Young Director, but let's be honest, I hardly ever use it. So my Instagram would be the best place if you're interested in keeping up with what I'm doing.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. We love all your work. We've said it before, fans of everything we've seen that you made, and Devil's Peak is no different. I think that our audience is very clear that we recommend seeing this as soon as possible, but thank you for taking the time. We really appreciate it. It's always great to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me once again and for asking such well-considered questions. And yeah, and if you like the movie, please spread the word, because it is a very independent film, and movies like this live and die on word of mouth. And so if you do like it, please tell your friends.
We will. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Absolute pleasure.
It was. Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day or night or whatever it is where you are.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, guys.
There you have it. That was our interview with Ben Young. Thank you again to Ben for taking the time to talk with us. It's always great to get the opportunity to pick his brain a little bit, and we really appreciate how thoughtful his answers always are and how kind he is.
Yeah, like I said in the intro, I mean, he was just super generous with his time, gave us great in-depth answers. Obviously, it's an interview, but he helps it feel conversational. We love having him on. Everybody go check out Devil's Peak, and hopefully we'll have him back on again sometime.
Yes, remember, Devil's Peak is in theaters now in America. If you're listening to this when the episode is releasing a little bit later in March, it'll still be in theaters, but if not, it's available video on demand for you to watch at home. But
go to the theaters if you can.
Yes, exactly. But a link to watch it will be in the description so you can see it at home, along with links to stream Ben's other feature films, Hounds of Love and Extinction, the latter of which is available on Netflix. Super easy if you have a subscription. So check out all of Ben's work when you get the chance. And again, a big thank you to him, not only for taking the time today and giving such great insight today, but for, like we said, his past interview with us, because he's now taken the time out multiple times to really give us great answers and insight into the industry and his work specifically. So thank you again, Ben, for that. We'll have another episode for you guys next week, most likely. Some exciting interviews coming up in the next 2 months, and we'll be back to a more dense release schedule soon as well. So get excited for all that and check out our back catalog of episodes if you missed any of our over 80 episodes we've already released. You can find us on any podcasting app by searching the letters GDT. That's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the free ones too. That's the end of the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Good Data Pod and on Facebook at GDT Podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
As always, thank you for tuning in, folks. We love you, and we'll see you on the next one.